analyst on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. Roadmap diplomacy picked up somewhat more emphasis this week as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas each visited Washington for talks with President George W. Bush and other American leaders. There has been virtually no violence between the two sides in 3 weeks, and talks are ongoing now on the issue of turning over responsibility for policing Arab areas in the West Bank and Gaza to the Palestinian Authority. The emerging point of contention appears to be Israel's insistence on continuing to build a barrier, a fence, or a wall to prevent militant Arab terrorists from entering Israel. Bush tried to convince Sharon to give up the project. Sharon ignored the president. That's the subject of the program today, but we're also going to take a little time to discuss the lighter side of the news, the newly emerging campaign by international professional soccer to bring the United States into the fold. Manchester United of the United Kingdom and Juventus of Italy are playing exhibition games in this country now to stimulate interest, and we'll catch up on that story as well. To discuss the Middle East, our guests today are, in Tel Aviv, Israel, Jay Bushinsky, Israel Bureau Chief of WINS Radio, in Ramallah, Palestine, Sam Bahor, a freelance journalist, and in Washington, Tamara Wittes, a Middle East specialist for the U.S. Institute of Peace. And to talk about soccer later in the program, we have in London Oliver Thompson, editor of Megasoccer.com, in Washington, Steve Goff, a sports writer for The Washington Post, and in Oakland, California, Mike Waitala, executive editor of the magazine Soccer America. Welcome to all. Let's start in the Middle East. There is a big difference of opinion on whether or not real progress is being made toward a roadmap settlement. Jay Bushinsky and Sam Bahor bring us up to date on what's going on. Sam, you go first.
Well, from my vantage point here in Ramallah, not much has changed since the roadmap was introduced, although on the late news every night we do hear about various incremental changes within the Israeli security apparatus around the Palestinian cities. There have been several internal checkpoints, military checkpoints, that have been removed. They've been replaced by multiple Israeli military movable checkpoints. So on the ground, not much has changed. We still have every Palestinian city under Israeli siege. We still live under Israeli occupation, and our right to travel, basically, and to move freely has been completely hindered by the Israeli military. Having said that, we do see some positive movement on the political front, at least, in the rhetoric that's being spoken on both sides of wanting to move forward. But as someone who's very practical, I'm waiting to see that translated on the ground.
Jay?
Well, I think that there was progress to a significant extent, because it began with the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the northern sector of the Gaza Strip, and it also led to a withdrawal from the ancient and sacred city of Bethlehem. So that's for starters. Yesterday there were talks between the Israeli and the Palestinian defense ministers on another set of withdrawals. Israel was prepared to withdraw from the city of Qalqilia, which abuts on Israeli territory, and from Jericho. But Security Chief Mohammed Dahlan insisted that Ramallah should be one of the two cities, and therefore there was no agreement. So that's on the side of deployment. As far as the other practical measures, it's a case of what's supposed to be. Israel's supposed to have agreed to admit 18,000 Palestinian day laborers through the various checkpoints. I think that's a significant development. The question, of course, is how many really came across? I can't count them. But for the first time, I saw a vehicle with a Palestinian license plate on the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem yesterday. That may mean something. Also, Israel has agreed to release 600 prisoners. They have not actually been released physically, but they're up for release, and then the releases will take place, I assume, very shortly. As far as the wall is concerned, that's another story. I'm sure we'll go into it in greater detail later.
Tamara Wittes, we have two different points of view. A Palestinian point of view that there is no progress, an Israeli point of view that there has been significant progress. How does it look in Washington?
Well, I think the two perspectives you just heard illustrate one of the real difficulties of getting this process going again, which is that there's a lot of discussion of quality of life. For Israelis, that means security. For Palestinians, it means freedom of movement, the ability to start rebuilding their society and economy. But what no one is talking about in these initial confidence-building measures is demonstrating good faith. The Palestinians may see some roadblocks removed, but they still are not convinced that this Israeli government is serious about giving them a viable state. On the Israeli side, they see a ceasefire. They feel a little bit freer to go out. But they're still not convinced that this Palestinian government is serious about tackling the terrorism problem, and therefore they don't have a lot of faith in their security if the Palestinians gain an independent state. So at the fundamental level, there's still a crisis of confidence between the two sides.
And how is the Bush administration operating in all of this? Is it doing the correct things, do you think?
I think it's been very helpful in getting the two sides talking again, which has really been the most significant development of the last few weeks, that they're meeting regularly and they're discussing these issues. And the question of the separation fence, I think, comes very much under the issue of a crisis of confidence. The Palestinians are saying that the construction of this barrier precludes absolutely the establishment of a viable, contiguous Palestinian state. And so for them, this isn't an interim issue. It's not a security issue. It's an issue as to whether the Israelis are serious about this peace process or not. That's why they pushed the issue so hard. And I think that's why the president has raised his own concerns about the fence with the Israelis.
Yeah. Jay, the fence also has the problem of being constructed to a great extent in Palestinian territory. And the Palestinians, as I understand it, are concerned that only means the Israelis are going to try to change borders before any final settlement. What about that?
Well, the problem basically is who started it, what caused it. That has to do with every situation, whether it's the difficulties that the Palestinians face at the roadblocks or the military checkpoints, or whether the fact that the laborers were not allowed to cross for so many months, there were over 100,000 coming in, more than 150,000 coming in before the second and the first intifada began. So the question always is, well, who started it? Is it the Israelis who've been moving in on the Palestinians for some reason to make their life more and more miserable? Or is it the Palestinians who've done things to antagonize or terrify the Israelis, and therefore they have been experiencing these reactions? I would like to just point out one thing. The fence went up by popular demand. It started in the northeast, where there were attacks on settlements that is not the post 1967 settlements, but pre-1967 settlements, where the farmers demanded that the government put up a barrier, and they began to put it up on their own without government funding until finally the government broke down and started building this fence or wall. If you take a close look at it, by the way, it looks more like a wall than a fence, but the Israelis don't like to admit that it's a wall, and that's a subject of semantics and debate. However, since the suicide bombing campaign, the government went after this wall even more determinedly, and the feeling in Israel was something's got to be done to keep these suicide bombers out, hence the wall. Now, in the middle of the construction phase, the peace process is renewed, and the question is, should they stop building the wall on the assumption that there will be peace, or should they go on building the wall on the hunch that it may not work out, and then they'll be facing the suicide bombing problem again? And in fact, there were two suicide bombing attempts in the past 2 weeks, which were foiled by the Israeli Secret Service. So therefore, there could be good reason to go ahead and keep building that fence.
Sam Bahour, do you think that the Palestinians are going to have any success in bringing the fence down?
Absolutely, we will. I mean, I think that one needs to understand and keep in mind that we're not in a marital dispute or a labor dispute with my Israeli neighbors. There needs to be a baseline for an equitable relationship between us. And regardless of what mistakes were made to make us reach to this point, I think that the baseline is international law and human rights. The baseline is that settlements, for example, are illegal and therefore must be dismantled. And the same applies to the wall. Building a wall on a land that is not yours is like the states putting a wall around Mexico and saying, well, there was popular demand to do so. Popular demand to me is something very, very serious if we start using it for justification for abusing human rights. There was popular demand in Europe for anti-Semitism. There was popular demand at the beginning of the building of the United States for slavery. There was popular demand in South Africa for apartheid. Popular demand to me does not constitute any kind of baseline for two parties to be able to build an equitable relationship. International law does, and I think that's where we need to start building from.
Yeah, Sam, you say human rights, but the ultimate human right is the right to life. And how can we talk about human rights when terrorism and killing of Israeli citizens is such a major aspect of the Palestinian drive toward autonomy and freedom?
Unfortunately, the terrorism is also in the settlements against Palestinians. The 2,000 and so Palestinians that have died within 2 years is a tragic incident as well. Terrorists need to be stopped and dismantled, both in the Israeli communities and in the Palestinian community. And I think until we realize that we cannot equate the occupier with the occupied in as a starting point for a solution, that, yes, we need both sides to take steps to omit terrorism from our societies, from our mindsets, and from anything we do. However, in the meantime, the issue that terrorism exists in the world can never be a justification to occupy another people forever. So I think that the beginning step needs to end the occupation, respect human rights on both sides, and those that do violate human rights and those that do violate the right to life need to be prosecuted, whether they're Palestinian, whether they're the Israelis, or whether they're somebody from Michigan that blew up the Oklahoma State Building. Every terrorist needs to be prosecuted to the last dot of the law.
I'd just like to interpose, if I could, though, two things. The most important thing is this. Not every Israeli is in favor of the wall, and not every Israeli is in favor of the settlements. But that doesn't make any difference if those people who are against those things happen to go in for a cup of coffee or stop at a shopping mall. They, too, may be blown up by a young woman or a young man with explosives around their waist. So that kind of tactic is not exactly, shall we say, fair play, and it's not something that people can just shrug off and say, well, we commit terrorism, you commit terrorism. I'm not going to argue the question whether the settlements are the equivalent of suicide bombings and therefore a form of terrorism. That's another question. The other minor point I'd like to raise before I get off is simply to remind you, Sam, that the West Bank was not taken from the Palestinians in 1967. The Palestinians didn't have it in 1967. Unfortunately, perhaps for them, but they didn't have it. Jordan had it. Israel took it from Jordan because Jordan opened fire on Israel, even when Israel urged Jordan not to open fire and assured King Hussein that nothing would happen to him if he stayed out of the Six-Day War, what turned into the Six-Day War. The Palestinians then found themselves under Israeli occupation, and then the issue of the status of the Palestinians, Palestinian nationhood, and aspirations came on the international stage. So I think we should keep everything in perspective. Israel did not go in to take it away from the Palestinians, that's for sure.
I would love to have another program where we can speak history, but I do agree in your beginning of your statement where, yes, everyone has a right to go to a shopping center, so I invite you to put your hand in my hand and let's destroy the conditions that allow people to have terrorism as a tactic.
True, but you'd be blown up with me. Sam, if I took you to the Ayalon shopping center outside Tel Aviv, you'd be blown up with me if a suicide bomber happened to come by at the same time. Would that be politically sensible? That wouldn't be politically sensible to me.
I think this back and forth actually gets at one of the key efforts underway in the current initiative between the Israeli government, the Palestinians, and the U.S. and the Quartet, which is to isolate those on both sides who hold extremist positions and those who are willing to back up those extremist positions with violence. What I think what the new Palestinian prime minister has been trying very hard to do within his own community, and it's a very difficult struggle, is to isolate the extremists, to isolate those who've been carrying out terrorism and say, this is not a legitimate part of our strategy, and this is not the path we're going to take. So you have a choice to make. You can either abandon this path and stay as part of the Palestinian national movement, or you can continue this path and we're going to have to spit you out. Rabin actually began to do this in the early years of the Oslo process. He ran up a lot against a lot of domestic opposition and eventually, sadly, resulted in his assassination. But this is a struggle on both sides to isolate and cast out those who oppose any kind of negotiated compromise.
I agree fully with you, Tamara. And I also would like to note that, unfortunately, it was an Israeli extremist that killed Rabin. But we don't find the Israeli government building a wall around this person's city. Building walls, building apartheid systems on an already very, very sensitive conflict can only engage in more violence. We need to stop the cycle of violence, and that's where I'm hoping that we can start from.
Sam, I think it was yesterday that Representative Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, said in Israel that responsibility for peace rested with the Palestinians, and that the Palestinians had to change their ways. How was that greeted in Palestine, and what effect did that have on Palestinian attitudes toward the United States?
I think it was greeted just like any other superficial comment from a politician trying to lay blame on one side or the other. Anyone who has, and I didn't hear the comment, so I can't go into detail, but anyone who has any kind of in-depth understanding of the conflict understands that it's not one person, one side did something and the other side has to pay the price for it. There are mistakes made in history, that's for another program, but for today, it's not the responsibility of one party. However, having said that, there's not an equal responsibility as well. There needs to be an application of international standards, I call it international law or human rights, as a starting point. If the starting point is just our popular demand, I would fear that many, many new conflicts will arise tomorrow in the world if popular demand is going to guide the way we solve conflicts. There needs to be a baseline, an internationally guided baseline that allows us to start. Occupation happens to be illegal. The United States itself has said settlements are illegal. We need to stop illegal actions if we're going to start building confidence.
Okay. Jay, I know you have to go, but I will give you the last word on this issue.
I just want to say, are you implying that the occupation by the United States of Iraq is illegal, Sam?
I think both are illegal, personally.
I beg your pardon?
I believe any occupation of a foreign country is illegal, in my point of view.
And the occupation of Germany by the United States after World War II was illegal?
We can discuss history in another program. We're talking about the Israeli occupation, military occupation for the last 35 years
general terminology.
Of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in East Jerusalem.
Okay, I'm sorry, but we do have to break this discussion off right now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. Well, let's go now from the Middle East to a much more frivolous story, and that is the story of the attempts to introduce international football, that's soccer in American terms, here in the United States. We have exhibition matches going on in a tour between Manchester United, the New York Yankees of international football, and Juventus of Turin, Italy, also a very, very strong team in the United States. Let's start with Steve Goff of the Washington Post. Steve, is this having any impact, and do you look forward to the day when you are covering major matches in the United States on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think it's definitely having an impact. There's a lot of soccer fans in this country. The sport certainly has a cult following. It's gained more wide mainstream acceptance, And, I mean, it's not just Manchester United and Juventus. AC Milan is here. Celtic of Glasgow, Scotland is here. And so, you know, Barcelona is here from Spain. So there's seven teams here, seven of the biggest names in international soccer. And it's certainly gaining a lot of attention in the cities where it's being played.
There have been attempts over the years to develop a world-class soccer league, they haven't really panned out. What has changed that is going to make this more possible now?
Well, I think Major League Soccer is slowly growing. It's a league that averages about 15,000 fans per game. In some ways it's done well, in some ways it hasn't. I think what they need to do is spend more money on better players, and that will attract bigger crowds. At the moment, it's a very modest league with stars from Central America and many of the American stars who did well at the World Cup in Asia last year. But if they want to take the next step up and draw bigger crowds and become more of an international presence, they're going to have to spend the money and get some of the stars that we're now seeing pass through here. Unfortunately, just for one or two games during these exhibition tours.
Mike Watala, do you see any possibility that the money is going to become available?
Well, you know, I got to say that when you talk about introducing international soccer to the United States as if it's something new is a little bit inaccurate, because you have to remember that we've had incredibly successful soccer events in the United States for years and years and years now. The 1994 World Cup had 3.5 million fans come to it in the United States, and that's the best attended World Cup ever. It still is. The 1988 Olympic Games were the best attended sport. Soccer was the best attended sport at those Olympic Games. And every time there's a big event, a big soccer event in the United States, it tends to draw huge crowds. Now, it's true, MLS averages about 15,000 fans per game, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, that's pretty much what most leagues in Europe, if you don't count the big ones like Spain, Germany, Italy, and England, draw. But the MLS final last year drew more than 60,000 fans. So, you know, I think soccer is a lot bigger in the United States than people give it credit for being.
And Oliver Thompson, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's been a definite growth in the past sort of 5 years, and MLS isn't doing that badly. When we hear over here that MLS has got 15,000 average attendance, I mean, there's plenty of leagues in Europe who'd be extremely proud of that sort of getting those sort of numbers through the gates. In terms of what this tour is doing from United and Juventus and Barcelona, I mean, these are big clubs. They're selling out, as far as I understand it, wherever they play. And if the people who are going to those games, if just a small percentage of the people who are going to those games get the book, start going to MLS games, then, you know, that's the first little bit of it cracked. Because once you get people going to watch domestic football, that's where the strength, both for the international team and for soccer across the states, is going to come from.
You know, actually, if I can throw something in there, in a way, this tour, though, this tour is obviously great for soccer in the United States because it gives it more attention, but it's also competition for Major League Soccer. I would say that one of the biggest problems that Major League Soccer has is that there is so much soccer available in the United States right now. For example, on television, with small dish or digital cable, a soccer fan can watch games of every major league in the world without leaving his living room in the United States. So what you have here is you have a league that's trying to get fans to come to its stadium. Now, these soccer fans, and we have plenty of soccer fans, we have enough soccer fans in the United States for this league to average 30,000 a game. But these same soccer fans have a choice on Saturdays. Do they sit home? They can, if they're Mexican-Americans, if they're fans of the Mexican League, they can actually see every single Mexican League game on television. So the league's challenge, and Steve talked about this earlier, is to put a product on the field that will make people want to go and watch Major League Soccer instead of maybe watch Chivas and Club America at home or watch Manchester United in the Premier League game. You know, we get Premier League games on television. There's so much soccer available here that that soccer competes with itself.
Yeah, Mike's right. And last night, for instance, in Washington, AC Milan, the European champion, played Barcelona. and it's a Wednesday night in the middle of the summer with ridiculous ticket prices, and 45,000 people showed up. And, I mean, these people love the game of soccer, and certainly a lot of people came down from New Jersey and Philadelphia area and some from New York. But, you know, this was a very diverse crowd. It was an ethnic audience. It was Anglo audience. It was young. It was old. It was an incredible crowd. And MLS's challenge is to attract these people that go that will come out for these big-time games to MLS games at the same time. But at the moment, if they have a choice, oftentimes, as Mike said, they're choosing to watch on TV their domestic leagues or just saving their money for big events.
Is the game of soccer going to have to be adapted in any way to the needs of commercial television in the United States to be successful?
Now, you know, we've done that already, or at least something incredible happened in 1994. They started showing soccer games in the United States without commercial interruption during the 2 45-minute halves. Now, unless you're watching public television, there is no television available in the United States, or except for maybe HBO, where you can go 45 minutes without commercial interruption. They actually made this adjustment because they figured out, you know, the television people, the soccer powers that be, that it's impossible to watch soccer with commercial interruptions. You know, back in the NASL days, we had a league with Pele and Beckenbauer, and there were crowds of 70,000 at Giant Stadium, and ABC started showing soccer games, and the first game they showed, they missed the gold because they went to a commercial break. But we've got beyond that. You know, I think the sponsors have realized that having their little logo next to the score on the top left-hand corner isn't that bad, and you can do graphics and things like that. So the good news is that American television has adjusted to soccer and not the other way around.
Stuart, you have 1 minute, please.
Okay. Steve Goff, would you just take a couple of seconds to talk about the impact of television and how their television and soccer will get along?
I think they're getting along pretty well, as Mike said, that they've worked out a way to show the games uninterrupted, which is unheard of in American sports. And but certainly the soccer needs to take advantage of television in the sense of finances. And once there's a demand to see the game on television, then they can the leagues can start making money.
Steve, I'm sorry, but we are out of time. Our guests today have been Jay Bushinsky of WINS Radio in Israel, Sam Bahor, a freelance journalist in Ramallah, Palestine, Tamara Wittes of the U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington, Oliver Thompson of Megasoccer.com in London, Mike Waitala, editor of Soccer America in Oakland, California, and again in Washington, Steve Goff of the Washington Post. Our director is Pat Akers, and our producers, Yusuf Kalyango and Sarah Katan. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.